Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Jared Hill, in for Steve Chiatakis.
Come on in.
Thank you.
We're in an old building on West 7th Street downtown. Up on the fifth floor, behind a glass door, are racks and racks of hundreds of fur coats and stoles made of mink, fox, sable.
Okay, so this is a mixed place. We have a showroom in the front. In the back, we have a vault where we keep our inventory.
This is Wachtenheim Furs. It's a wholesaler that sells to stores and private customers around town.
We deal with people bringing in their old furs, their mother's furs, their grandmother's furs, and they want to change the style and update it. So this is something that I learned to do from my father, who was in this business. And it's the only business he did when he was in the United States, because he came here from Czechoslovakia after World War II. And he survived the Holocaust and came to America, and he got into the fur business. I'm going to run it till the end so you can see.
Daniel Wachtenheim's family has been in this business ever since.
My father's mother and four sisters were all exterminated upon arrival at Auschwitz, and that included his little nieces, little nephews, all taken to the gas chambers. So my father survived this horror, this tragedy, and came to America after the war, and his brother was working in the fur industry. So he got a job in one of the fur places sweeping the floors. And he tells me the story that he would sweep the floors, and at night his brother would show him how to run that machine that we just were on, the bonus sewing machine. And he saved a few dollars, and he would buy a couple of skins. With those skins, he made a collar. He sold the mink collar. And then with that money, he went and he bought four skins. And he sold those two collars, made out of two skins, and took the money and bought another few skins. Eventually, he bought a little bundle of skins, and he made a mink stole. And then he sold the mink stole, and that's how he built up his livelihood.
From one collar, yeah.
I had worked with my father as a child here and there, but in 1983, I joined him. And he taught me the trade, and he taught me how to sew, and he taught me how to make patterns, and he taught me everything. And then I'm in the space now that I am for 30 years on my own. And I have a few workers here who all have been in this trade also their whole lives, just as I have.
But Daniel's livelihood is threatened now. A bill in the state assembly would ban the sale of new furs in California. And if that happens?
I really don't know what I will do. I don't know what my workers will do. I don't know what their families will do. The likelihood of these people who work for me being on the street is a big possibility, because they know nothing other than the skills of working in the trade of fur.
KCRW reporter Benjamin Gottlieb visited Wachtenheim's store and has been reporting on this state bill, and he joins me now. Hey, Benjamin.
Hello, Jared.
At the risk of sounding ignorant, I had no idea this was such a big business still. My first question is, who is still buying furs? This is still a thing.
It's definitely still a thing. And Wachtenheim told me that his clients are primarily Jewish customers, Persian customers, Korean customers, and also Black Angelenos. Mm-hmm. I don't want to generalize, but this is a status symbol, also a symbol of wealth still for many people living here in Los Angeles, regardless of the fact that it gets very, very hot.
Wow.
There's still clients that are going and buying furs in the summer and the fall. And it's a big business with a lot of zeros. I spoke with a spokesperson for the Fur Information Council of America. It's actually based here in Porter Ranch. He told me that the retail figures for fur sales in the U.S. each year, around $1.5 billion on average.
Wow.
And in California, $300 million.
That's a pretty significant piece of that pie. This is apparently a much bigger business than I ever realized. Who is supporting this bill, and are they worried about folks like Daniel Wachtenheim?
Yeah, so this bill is generally being supported by animal rights activists, also an assembly member from the Glendale-Burbank area. Her name is Laura Friedman. Now, one of those animal rights activists is a man named Mark Ching. He works in Sherman Oaks, and his nonprofit is called the Animal Hope and Wellness Foundation. You can hear right there, he's got dozens upon dozens of dogs at his center right on Ventura Boulevard. And they went a bit nuts when I walked in to meet up with him. So we went outside to talk. Ching actually travels around the world visiting places like dog meat farms in China and South Korea. And a lot of the dogs that you hear there are rescued from places like that. So here's what he says about the fur industry and how they should adapt to this bill.
you know, any job loss or financial impact to anybody is unfortunate. However, as cultures change and as our communities ask for more humane products, that's the natural transition of a society, is to evolve. And as a person, if you are, your whole life is predicated on something as cruel as a fur industry, one day that will catch up to somebody or an industry. And, you know, as human beings, we have to understand that and we have to prepare for that. And I believe that's what they're going to have to do.
So that's Ching's perspective. It's a perspective shared by animal rights activists. They say that fur and the harvesting of animals for their fur is cruel. And he pointed to some other examples, such as cosmetic testing on certain animals, slaughterhouses that maybe in the past had inhumane practices, treatment of animals. He said people were employed in those businesses, but they had to adapt because morality changed and because the laws changed. And again, Mark is hoping that California is going to lead the way to ending this whole business of selling new fur.
Well, a few years ago, I went undercover to different countries, Finland, Canada, China, of course, and in the U.S. to different fur farms to kind of see what happens there. And after seeing the reality that these animals have to suffer through and how they're born in a cage and literally live their whole life in a cage and then are brutally, like, killed, we thought that if we could ban fur in California, especially Los Angeles where it started, then that could translate to the whole United States and hopefully bring an end to an industry we consider cruel.
And by the way, you heard Los Angeles there. There is a ban in the city of Los Angeles on new fur sales. That's going to be going into effect in the next several months or so. I asked Ching also if he believes there is a humane way to do this. Is there a humane way to harvest fur from animals? He told me that in all his travel, he hasn't seen it.
So that kind of leads me to the next part of this that's interesting, is this bill doesn't ban the sale of all products made from animal skins or fur. There are some exceptions, right?
That's true, and that's a good point. So leather, skins from cows, right? Yeah. Cattle, deer, sheep, goat skin, for example, all those things are exempt from this bill. And if you ask Assemblymember Laura Freeman about that, she wrote this bill. She's the Democrat from the Glendale Burbank area. She says she's interested in reducing waste and making sure that the entire animal is being used when it is harvested.
Okay.
With the more traditional fur animals like mink and fox and coyote, those animals are not being used for anything except for their fur. It's the only reason that they're being taken out of the wild and slaughtered. And that is not a sustainable practice.
This isn't the only fur-related action that's taking place in the state capitol. What can you tell us about some of the other bills?
Yeah, well, one of those bills is now a law. Governor Gavin Newsom signed it this week, and it bans fur trapping. This is commercial and recreational, so going around out in the wild, trapping an animal just for its fur. And California became the first state in the nation to do so. There's another bill that is on the floor right now. It would outlaw the use of animals in any circus in the state. So this is kind of part of this fur ban, potential fur ban. It's part of a larger push in the state legislature and a push by animal rights activists to get through some of this new legislation about the treatment of animals in California.
Okay, so ultimately, do we think that this is going to pass the legislature?
Well, it passed a major hurdle this week, the Senate Appropriations Committee. That's commonly known in Sacramento as the place that bills go to die.
Okay.
And it cleared a big hurdle there, so it's going to be taken up. It's planned to be taken up on the Senate floor, state Senate floor, next week. And remember, Democrats have the supermajority in Sacramento. So if you are reading the tea leaves, it's looking pretty good for this bill, but we'll have to wait and see what happens.
Interesting. All right, KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb. Thank you.
Anytime.
Our music situation is very legit right now. I want to let you know that you can join, renew, or upgrade your membership before midnight tonight, and you'll be automatically entered to win a pair of weekend VIP passes to Desert Days. It's the 8th annual Desert Days Festival. Go to kcrw.com/join. Coming up, have you heard of a group called Fix the City? They're behind a new lawsuit against the city. We're going to hear what they're upset about coming up next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're back with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Jared Hill. A housing program that's been called one of LA's biggest successes is under attack. LA's Transit-Oriented Communities program lets developers build denser, taller housing near major bus and train lines, with incentives for including affordable units. The idea is to tackle two problems with one stone: a housing shortage that's pushed prices to record levels, and pollution by getting people out of their cars. But the program is now being challenged by an organization with a long history of fighting new development. The nonprofit Fix the City is suing to end the program. They claim it violates city and state laws. Jim O'Sullivan is a member of Fix the City. Hey, Jim.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for being here. So your lawsuit is based on technicalities having to do with how this program, the Transit-Oriented Communities program, has been implemented. But what about the basic idea of building more housing near public transit? Do you think that's something LA needs to do?
It may be. That's the theory. However, I'm in the Miracle Mile. We've had 4,000, maybe 5,000 new apartment buildings on Wilshire Boulevard and the Miracle Mile and the surrounding area based. And, you know, you would think all these people are going to come down and get on the bus and go somewhere. The developers keep building parking spaces for cars because those people do not take the buses. They come down, they get in their cars, and they go. So just simply say we're going to keep building more along transit corridors and people will automatically then get on the buses or get in the subway does not seem to be the case today. And these projects that are going up are not paying good family supporting jobs. And people are absolutely shocked at this because part of Measure JJJ was, yes, we need more affordable housing, but we also need to pay a prevailing wage so that those people who labor to build those projects could also afford to maybe live in them or to live nearby.
I want to pause you there, because are you saying that your real concern is about people not making living wages? That's what I'm hearing you say, but I want to be clear.
People went into the vote, in the voting booth on November 8, 2016. There were a lot of things there. One was Measure JJJ. It made certain promises, and it was a bargain that the people made. And they said, okay, if we approve this legislation, which we hope will do X, Y, and Z, and it will limit the city's ability to amend or to deny any of these projects, if we do this, we will get certain things. We will get affordable housing and we will get good jobs with families, you know, supporting wages. What I'm saying is the city did a bait and switch. The city had people vote for something, and now what they're doing is we're getting the buildings, of course, but people are not getting the family supporting wages. And so we're suing to say, hey, the voters approved something, and it's the clear language of the initiative that the city is supposed to initiate.
Okay, this lawsuit seeks to block one specific project in Santa Monica Boulevard near Century City. It's about 7 stories tall, 120 units. Tell me what's wrong with that project specifically.
One of the problems that it's built on the Aquas Friolo fault line. That's one of the problems. It's in the city. The city calls it a no-build zone, but they decided to do it anyway. So that's one thing. The other thing is that they are allowing incentives that were never approved by the voters in Measure JJJ. That's what we really want. We want the city to go back and to look at the clear language of Measure JJJ and put in the incentives based on that.
Where does Fix the City's money come from? Because your lawsuits impact the entire city and its landscape. So I think it's a fair question to ask. Where are you funded?
No, it's not a fair question.
It's not?
No, it's none of your business.
It's none of my business. You don't think it's the business of the people who are going to be impacted by the lawsuits that you're filing?
No.
Okay. How many people make up Fix the City?
You know what? It is a 501c4, and that's what we're doing. I mean, go ask the city. They know who we are.
If the city knows who you are, then it should be an easy answer for you. Am I correct?
No, the city can tell you who we are, who they think we are. You know, I am not.
But you can't tell me who you are.
Who we are, where we're funded. That's not a question that I'm going to answer. It has nothing to do with this lawsuit.
We're going to move on because
Thank you very much.
I'm sure you know that the people that are pushing back against this called your group a bunch of NIMBYs whose purpose is to really stop neighborhoods from changing.
Of course
they do. And they also feel, let me finish. They feel like you don't want neighborhoods to change and you don't want to make room for other people that would seemingly be black, brown, lower income, and, you know, bringing in different types of people.
Oh, my God. That.
What do you say to that?
I say it's absolute bullshit. Now, if you want to go to census tracts and look where I live in the Miracle Mile, where I've lived for 32 years, one of the things is we have a lot of Latinos, we have a lot of blacks, we have a lot of Asians, and yes, there were Caucasians living here when I moved in. This is not, I mean, my God, sticks and stones will break my bones. I understand that. And I understand that Abundant Housing and a few other groups are going to come after us. Hammer and tong. Got it. I understand it. But I don't get paid for any of this. This much I can tell you. I do not draw a salary. What I do is for fun and for free. I don't know about the people that are complaining. If they're making a living at it, I don't know. I don't care. It's none of my business. But I don't. I put in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours. People call me from all over the city asking me about issues. And I do my best to help them. That's who I am, and that's who Fix the City is.
Okay, so we know that LA has a homelessness crisis. We know there's an affordable housing crisis. If you're against building denser projects with affordable units near public transit, where do you suggest that more housing should get built? Where should those people go?
Well, I don't think anyone in Fix the City or any of the groups that I know about would object to a 100% affordable housing project anywhere. But that's not what we're getting, and I hope you understand that. We're getting massive amounts of market rate housing, maybe 10, 11% affordable. That's better than nothing, but it's not going to end our crisis. It's not going to end our homelessness crisis. So we're not against development unless you're trying to build a, I don't know, 30-story building on a residential street. That's a little bit bad, but projects are projects.
Jim O'Sullivan is a member of Fix the City, a nonprofit suing the city over its transit-oriented communities program. Thank you for being here, Jim.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
I'm now joined by Alyssa Walker, who just heard that interview. She is the urbanism editor at Curbed LA. Alyssa, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Your top line thoughts?
It's the same arguments that this organization has been making and the same lawsuits that this organization has been making for several years. Anytime a development or a project or a program from the city wants to increase density, make transit better, allow more people to live in different places, there is a lawsuit from this group.
What has the Transit-Oriented Communities Program produced so far? What's come from them?
So this has been not just one of the most successful programs in the city, but one of the most successful programs in the state for proposing affordable housing.
When we say successful, define that.
So if you just look at the numbers, and this is just what's been proposed. It doesn't mean it's been built yet. Yeah. Like, you know, many of the projects are under construction. So you're looking at 20,000 units that have been proposed. And of those, one-fifth of them will be for low-income or very low-income families that move in there. That is astounding.
Yeah.
I mean, even if, you know, half of these get built within the next few years, that's a really good incentive program. It's showing that we are able to take advantage of a person who already wants to build housing for people and add a few more units for people to live in these neighborhoods that are desirable and are close to jobs and schools, but also that they're close to transit. So we're putting people in a place where we know that their carbon footprint will be a little bit smaller.
So Jim told us that this program is not the deal presented to voters in Measure JJJ. I know that you pulled up the language because you felt like there's a little something more there.
Well, it explicitly says in JJJ, which I have to say, I don't know if you mentioned this, but it passed with 64.8% of the vote. So it had to have a two-thirds majority already.
They just made that,
and they just made it. But that's definitely a majority, a clear majority of the city. So Measure JJJ passed. And it says in the language, an ordinance that is creating an affordable housing incentive program for developments near major transit stops. And then when you go down into the city of Los Angeles language, it says a yes vote means you want to amend city law to add affordable housing standards and training, local hiring, prevailing wage requirements for certain residential projects seeking general plan amendments or zoning changes. So I think the big argument that this is a trick or this is different than what was presented to voters isn't really true, because you are saying we want to incentivize developers to build more affordable housing near transit, and the city could come up with a way to do that.
Mm-hmm. And with the goal of bringing in all of those other elements, correct?
Yes, I think like the other parts of it are really important to getting it passed, because this was construction workers and people who wanted to be paid prevailing wage, and groups that wanted to make sure that we continued to build things. You have to remember, this was proposed at a time when another group that likes to sue the city a lot, the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, was proposing what would eventually become Measure S. And they were wanting to stop all mega developments. This was in 2016. They wanted to stop these large developments from happening completely. They wanted a blanket ban on any kind of large project going up in the city. So this was actually proposed at a time when people were worried that we weren't going to be building enough housing. We weren't going to be employing people to build some of this housing.
Wow. Okay. So I want to know, what have been the outcomes in the past with other lawsuits like this from Fix the City? Have they succeeded? Did they slow things down? Like, what did they do?
Definitely slowing things down, I think, is the goal of lawsuits like this that we see, not just from this group, but other ones. There is another lawsuit that's pending right now that would stop adding more housing along the Expo Line, which is, again, if you want to add housing someplace in the city, it also would add inclusive units. So, again, getting some of the families who are lower income to move closer to desirable places, like closer to Santa Monica and the West Side. This is just something that's been done a lot. A lot of people call it green mail. You're using some of the environmental regulations at the state and city level, something called CEQA, which you might have heard when you go to these wonky planning meetings, and you try to argue against developments or other changes based on, I've heard fault lines come up, I've heard this argument against traffic, you hear all these other arguments, and you try to get money from the developers or the city or, you know, different entities. And it's a ongoing and regular part of the any kind of thing that's proposed for the city.
And is there any perspective on how big these groups are, Fix the City and other groups like this?
I do think that it would be good to know how many people are proposing these lawsuits. If it's an entire group, you often see a lot of groups like neighborhood organizations or other coalitions, maybe of advocates coming together to propose lawsuits. But in this case, it's hard to know if it's just really someone paying a lawyer to make a lot of noise.
What do you think needs to change to, quote, fix the city? How do you feel like we should be addressing this? Or do you feel like the way that we're going about it is the right way to go?
I think taking the affordable housing part of it out, because we do need to get that built, and I think they agree. The argument that keeps coming up is that we're building all these units next to transit, and ridership is still going down, and people are still driving their cars. But they have fought a better transit system at the same time. You need those bike connections. You need walking connections. You need better bus lanes that go faster than the cars on these streets to ensure that people can get to their destinations and actually start to envision living without a car in the city. On the other hand, people who live in affordable housing projects in parts of the city don't have access to cars at all. So wouldn't you want to ensure that that would be the first thing in place, get as many units as possible for people who can live close to transit and not have to save up to buy a car or need to get access to one? So it's these two arguments that keep circling around each other, and just trying to sue both sides of it means we're not going to create the city that I think we all want.
Well, because this weekend I was on the expo line with a friend, and she'd gotten a bike and I got one of those scooters, and we went like 8 miles or something. We went a really long, we rode for like an hour and a half all the way from Santa Monica all the way to Culver City. And it was a great way to be able to kind of, you know, travel the city without having to get in a car. And, you know, if people could get access to the trains or get access to different parts of the city that way, it seems like it would probably ease up a little bit of traffic. So.
And you can see it every time there's an open streets event like Ciclovia. You have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people out in the street. They all have bikes or scooters in their garages. They bring them out. And then on Monday, they're back in their car because they don't have access.
Alyssa Walker is the urbanism editor at Curbed LA. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So much going on today. We want to thank everyone that was a part of the show and want to remind you that you can join, renew, or upgrade your membership during KCRW's UnDrive Pledge Drive to be automatically entered to win KCRW's Sonoma Getaway Sweepstakes. All the information on how you can participate is at kcrw.com/join. Make sure that you support. We really do appreciate it. Bookworm is up next right here on KCRW. Have a good one.